Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, all three engines up and burning, 2, 1, 0, and lift off.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Dave Briglia with Making the Play. And this week, we're going to be talking about a topic that usually we're on the positive side here, but this is important. This is about where bullying comes into play. And I've got two researchers who are more than that. They're taking action. So bringing on board here, Jennifer Frazier and Chuck Bichon, are you with us?
How are you doing?
We are.
We're here.
Excellent. Well, again, I'm going to let you two introduce yourselves, but everybody, I think what you're going to find here is this is definitely a topic that you'll see in the news, but it's usually about kids doing it to kids, and it becomes the teacher, the coach, the adult in the room that's supposed to be stopping these things, and it's as far as what it does to kids. And how we, the other adults, respond to it. So give a little introduction about the type of research you're doing and what brought you here.
I guess I began about 5 years ago looking closely at emotional abuse, because even though I'd been a teacher at all levels for 20 years practically, I'd never heard a workshop, I'd never heard a discussion, never had a professional development day. And so because of a personal situation where I'd taken direct reports from students at a school I was working at that they were being essentially emotionally abused by teachers, and it was in a sport context, I began starting my research. And the second I began, I never stopped, and it culminated in my book, which is called Teaching Bullies. And really, the second I read this information, I wanted to share it with everybody. I think all coaches deserve a proper education. All teachers need to know about this, all parents and all kids. So that's really where I began becoming very passionate about this.
And Charles, how did you, I guess, come across Jennifer and come into the conversation here?
Well, Jennifer and I actually became in conversation, believe it or not, through social media. I posted something. I don't know if it thrilled her too much, and then we started the discussion, and the next thing you know, we've been talking ever since. I've been in research in the area for approximately 5 years now at the University of Central Florida, and I myself was a victim, and I had a daughter that was a victim. And it's just progressed since then with the need to finally try to do something about it to help.
And I think also, I don't want to put a spoiler here, but one of the things we are going to get into here is one of the tools, the application that you've put together and how people can be empowered in taking action. Jennifer, you know, what got you, again, you're doing some research and there were some personal issues, but what's the, you know, kind of starting this off, why isn't there something more in place here with all the research you found? What's a place to start the conversation here? What's the biggest gap?
Well, in the work that I did, what I found was, and this is very related to the kind of work that Charles was doing as well in his dissertation, when you start to work on this issue, the biggest thing that jumps out at you is the fact that there's no laws. There is absolutely no laws in place that are clear and that protect children's brains. So, and I say brains because although we have very clear laws on physical abuse, very clear laws on sexual abuse, you instantly are charged criminally for conduct that hurts children's bodies, you have carte blanche, essentially, from the law to harm children's minds. And it's really insidious what emotional abuse does. And when I say emotional abuse, just to give you an image of it, It's yelling in a kid's face. It is swearing, personal put downs, homophobic slurs. It's ignoring them when they speak to you, walking away, neglecting their feelings, pushing them to play when they're injured. These are all things that are mental. They're psychological. They don't leave a scar on the body. But what we do now know through neuroscience, they leave a scar on the brain. And that's why I'm so intensely involved in trying to make people understand that we have to change the laws. We needed them changed yesterday. And, I mean, it's not really anyone's fault. Coaches, parents, we've all grown up in a bullying paradigm, but now it's time. Now that we have the science, we have to all work hard together to change that paradigm into something healthy for our children.
And I check with that. Has your research come across, again, the neuroscience part? Because there is an awful lot more of that out there. And often it seems to be going more towards, you'll see apps for better memory, mindfulness, things like that. But this is a different side. What in your research have you been finding about that?
Well, the amazing thing is that we are literally just touching the surface of the neuroscience area when it's related to bullying in general. The scars are scars. I mean, we're talking about the human brain. It's truthfully no different than if you were doing research in a concussion area. The damage that's done is there. It's permanent. And it recurs. It continuously comes back. So once the individual has been a victim of bullying, those scars never disappear. So what I found is with those reoccurrences, with the neuroscience part, when you directly harm an individual, like Jennifer kind of pointed out, there's certain scars that you can see. We can tell if somebody's cut. We can tell if they've been physically abused. The brain takes a little bit more of a mechanism to be able to see it. And it's not always seen instantaneously because we can't do CAT scans on everybody while they're out on the field to find out what it's doing. So it takes a little bit more time to deal with, which is a lot of the reason why my research led me into not only the reporting systems of manners of how people can report for safe issues, but also the self-perception of the coaches themselves, or teachers or any adult and other athletes that potentially are bullies. There's a difference in perception of what they perceive okay compared to what they perceive others to do being okay. So there's almost that level of self-protection that they go through inside themselves to make themselves believe that what they're doing is okay when it's really not.
Yeah, in fact, I just finished I started this actually before I came across Jennifer on social media. Again, it's amazing how who you can come across that is an interest you just want to talk to him. But I was just finished a book by a psychiatrist, and very much into PTSD, in the 60s, 70s, and moving on here. And he talks about the fact that it's often the motivation is that inside they feel weakness. So as soon as they see it in somebody else, they just detest it and feel they have to pay. It's a very complex thing. I am, this is not my trade, but he explained it to that point, which it is, it's a deep thing that's driving them and motivates them. It's different than just being, rude or having an off day with someone. And I think, Jennifer, I think it was in your book that, one of the descriptions of the definition, it's not about just kids or people just being hard on each other and overly critical, at one moment, one thing. It's a pattern.
Well, definitely, this is where I think the work that Charles is going to be doing is going to be very important, because certainly in the research, there is a definite pattern. And so in the personal situation that I was involved in, where students were reporting, there was at least 14 students came forward with reports of teacher abuse. And the police read their reports, and they said there is a definite pattern of emotional and verbal abuse. And so you could see that what the police does is they look for the pattern. What's so sad, though, and this goes back to the question around the law, the police could do nothing to protect these children, because if emotional abuse is not in the criminal code, no police officer, even though they know abuse is happening, they can't press charges. They can't stop the situation. They can't get the teacher away from the child until there's a proper investigation and allegations are dealt with, et cetera. So we got caught in this situation, as you know from reading the book, where the police couldn't press charges, and we were just drawn into this horrendous re-victimization of all the kids that reported. So, I mean, these are the kinds of major aspects of how we handle child reports of adult bullying. These are the things we have to address.
Well, you mentioned re-victimization. And I think, you know, we've all seen it, truthfully, on TV. Scenes, and they have it, but I don't think it really hits home. Can you describe what that is, especially in this case of whether it's kids or young adults? What is that re-victimization?
Well, what happened was the students reported. They did all the things that they were supposed to do, all the things they were asked to do. They handed over. They were all asked if they agreed to send their material, their reports of the abuse into the headmaster. This was at a private school. And the headmaster, you know, promised them confidentiality, and he met with the ones that were still available at the school, because there was kids reporting from university. Some kids were in second-year university all the way down to grade 10, and this goes back to the pattern. They were reporting literally the same words being said, the same gestures, the same yelling, the same targeting of one kid and putting the other up on a pedestal, this pattern of conduct. And so he met with, I think, 7 or 8 of these students. And then afterwards, instead of dealing with the situation and protecting them and addressing whatever he needed to do with the teachers, I mean, really they should have been instantly suspended and off campus and getting better, basically. The parents were asking for the coaches or the teachers to have a chance to get better, because we all believe that, you know, like you're saying, it's a complex psychological problem. The person is mentally ill, frankly, and they need to get better. They need healing. There's no point in necessarily penalizing them, but you also need some kind of legal repercussion in place to protect children. So it needs to be just a better system. But the re-victimization came when the headmaster brought in a lawyer, had the lawyer write a report, didn't like what he heard, I guess, because he suppressed the report. No one was allowed to read it from the parents or the school community. He then had another report done, and the parents thought the lawyer would be fine. They agreed to bring in this guy. And this, I mean, there shouldn't even be lawyers in the first place. This lawyer wrote a 10-page report, and the headmaster, without asking permission of the children or the parents, the students or the parents, he published it to around 300 or more people. And it essentially positioned the kids who spoke up and reported the abuse as liars. It insinuated it. I mean, he couldn't come right out and say it, because it's just, I mean, he would open himself up to defamation probably. What he said was, is other anonymous students reported that the kids that said abuse was occurring were, quote-unquote, telling nasty lies, and their parents were, quote-unquote, manufacturing evidence. So, I mean, of course, anyone who reads it, who doesn't know what's going on, believes that this is the case. It came out of the authority of the headmaster's office. This is what I mean by re-victimization.
And that is something, I think, that everybody, I mean, going back to, you know, 30, 40 years ago when we were kids, that is something you worry about, you know, about speaking up. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I don't think I ever witnessed true bullying, but probably things that had they kept up, they were probably, you know, step one, they were in a big pattern. And it was more of, again, we said, well, it's just guys being guys, you just got to deal with it, and that's how you get through it, and you move on. But mm-hmm. Definitely when I think back below the surface, you know, when you kind of see things and, you know, just it's time to watch your back, it was, I don't want to be one of those people that everyone's going to, you know, start going after because of they don't believe it. How hard is it going to be? And so forth. And with that, Chuck, you know, you mentioned it was you personally, then with your daughter. How did that come into play, that re-victimization, or did it with? Or was that something that you were dealing with, or you just blew right past that worry?
Well, mine ended up being more of a pattern of events. With me, it took me over 25 years to even realize that I was a victim. Because as you stated, there was always more of that macho atmosphere where it was, oh, it was just the way we grew up, or it was boys being boys, or kids being kids, or that's just how you motivated people. It made me realize what happened to me when actually it happened to my daughter. But what I also noticed too, when we talk about the pattern of events as far as the trait of a bully, we also have to discuss the fact that bullying is a learned trait. So what I noticed in myself was, when I went back and reflected, is I was bullied. I learned how to be a bully from the person that bullied me, and then I became the bully. So when I was the bully is when I actually realized that I was a victim of bullying, and did some research into it and found out that there is actually a pattern that shows that victimization in general, not just bullying, is a learned trait. So what we deal with now, not only with the pattern of events that happened with Jennifer, but also the pattern of the learning, is basically we have kids who are being victimized by adults in sport and out of sport that are learning that this is the way to get ahead, even though it's not. So then they become sympathetic to it and then learn the trait and then learn to do it themselves. And then they grow up to be in that position, which a great example is athletics, because the athlete becomes the coach. And then them as coaches coach in the manner that they learned from being coached that way. And then the pattern of victimization continues. So in order to break that pattern, we need these individuals, like with Jennifer's example and with mine as well, to have a not only a legal aspect, but just some form of repercussion for their actions, even if it's just reeducating, training, trying to heal these individuals that are the victimizers, in order to allow them to not do it any, to not continue the pattern, but also to still be productive citizens in their area. Because just because you're a victimizer doesn't mean you're not a great technical coach. It just means that the mental side of it, you can't necessarily deal with a one-on-one situation with an athlete, because you don't know how to handle it, because you were never taught, because their coaches had a tendency to bully as well.
Right. And one of the things, on a lighter side, again, you know, two of the episodes you've had with the Positive Coaching Alliance, and they are there's just not ways. And one of the ways they put it is that when you're yelling, it's because you got nothing else, you know, in the toolbox at that moment. I mean, that's really, that's what it is. And when you get to the degree you're talking about, that's because they were never taught there was anything else worth having in the toolbox. There's a difference between having a bad moment and that's your end.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Having one bad moment is completely different than having a pattern of events. But that one bad moment is what leads to those patterns of events. It's just
right,
an idea of being able to identify them.
Right, and if it's you're seeing that repeated around you, I mean, it is a pack social mentality, and that's why really the reason a lot of the things we talk about here start with sports is because Rick Giroux on the show a few weeks ago had mentioned this is how we bring kids into society. I mean, we've got them chasing the ball before, you know, they can do, you know, math or anything else. So it's not isolated to this, because in fact, I mean, I definitely know in the classrooms where it had nothing to do with athletics. And of course, then you see it in the workplace. And that's one of the things that actually, when I think of the incidents, I've had more incidences from supervisors where that has been a case and have had to weather it. And fortunately, again, I had a pretty good upbringing and things like that. But the other thing that you'll see too is getting a little bit off topic here is that, you know, in the workplace, it's only been in the last, I would say, decade that women are playing a more equal role in their authority. But I think they're coming from a wounded place as well, because 3 out of 4 of the instances I had have all been from women who were initially friends. And then you found that dual personality, which takes me to another point in the book. That was something else that was in your book, Jennifer, about that's what makes it so hard, is that dual personality that's presented.
Well, I mean, going back to a random incident of losing your temper or yelling or saying something inappropriate, or, I mean, every single adult who raises children has done that, let alone teachers with students, I mean, especially, and coaching, it's all so intense. That's not at all what we're talking about. What
Right.
we're talking about is a person that is, and it's what you're talking about in the workplace, where you get this sudden switch, where you have somebody who presents as, and this is typical for child bullies as well, they're popular, they're powerful, they're well-liked, these are common traits. They're Dr. Jekyll traits, which is how I think of it. And then all of a sudden, when you are the target, you see the Mr. Hyde part of it. And so the teachers that I'm talking about, I mean, they were calling the team, I can't even say the words on the radio because it would get you in trouble. They were calling them effing female anatomy. They were calling them effing retards, pathetic, embarrassments. I mean, they would push and push and push until some of these, like, these were incredible athletes. They're 17, 18-year-old boys practicing 6 days a week, like, so intensely in love with the game and wanting to play at the highest level, and they would have them in tears because it was so ugly what they were saying. And, you know, now that I've done the research, I understand that that's exactly the type of approach that a bullying educator, parent, you know, there's people grow up with parents where they never hear a kind word. They never hear anything of encouragement or motivation or that they're proud. All they hear is a relentless stream of criticism. And that's bullying. That's bullying on the playground. It's bullying in the house. It's bullying on the court. It's bullying in a classroom. It's bullying in the workplace.
And you mentioned that age, 17, 18, and also in your book you talk about, I think it was the range, maybe 13 to 24, the neuroplasticity. How important is that age? Again, it's not coincidental. That is the point at which school and sports and early in the career, you know, the first supervisor, all that is right in that zone right there.
Well, I think it goes back to what you were saying about PTSD, because one of the things that I found fascinating was that the experts are well aware that a child with neuroplasticity, so ages from sort of 12 to 25, when they are in that heightened state of brain development, they are as fragile brain-wise as a toddler. Now, we would never get up in a toddler's face and yell at them. We would never haul them to the side for a scene of public humiliation. You know, we tiptoe around these little tiny people because they have very fragile brains, and we know that. Well, the neuroscientists now know that the adolescent brain is just as fragile. It's just as fragile. So you're looking at an 18-year-old. He looks like a man, but his brain is not a man's brain. It's a highly plastic brain and very susceptible to PTSD. Now, you can take an adolescent brain and you can fire it up to be the most powerful, fastest learning, creative, innovative, risk-taking thing on the planet, or you can put it in a toxic environment with a bullying educator and you can wreck it. And, you know, Dr. Martin Tyker out of Harvard, he sees shrinkage in the corpus callosum. What parent would sign on to let their kid play a sport if they knew it was going to damage their brain? Tracy Vinecourt, University of Ottawa, cortisol spikes up into bullied brains even when young people are anticipating it, not just suffering it, thinking about how it's going to come again at practice. They're going to be put down. They're going to be humiliated. They're going to be sworn at. They're going to be shoved into position. And their brain starts spiking cortisol. That just burns stuff up. And it hits all the parts that matter, learning, memory, decision-making, all the things we're trying to develop in children. Dr. Daniel Siegel says the amygdala will be on constant alert for a child that is bullied, especially by an educator. So, I mean, it's serious stuff. Like Chuck was saying, it's long-term damage.
And, Chuck, do you want to add to that? Because like I said, you know, I know that your research also, and you just, by the way, Chuck also just got through his doctoral exams this week, so he is definitely in the heat of all this. What are you seeing here?
This, as Jennifer was saying, it baffles me to imagine, first off, that when we're talking about youth, we're talking about, you know, we can say 21 and under just to be safe, but we're talking about developing minds that not only parents should be considered protecting, but any adult should be protecting these individuals. And without the educational path that these adults are not in position to have, because either they have never been influenced by a form of education to teach them how to do these things, or have, like we discussed prior, been involved in situations where they themselves have been the victim, and they've just learned it as a learned trait, what I'm starting to find is that really these individuals don't know they're doing wrong. And that's 99.9% of the problem is when we talk about coaches specifically, if these coaches do not know they're doing wrong, we can't expect them to do right. And then there's also the fact that a lot of these coaches, too, they don't sign up to be, I don't want to use the term sympathetic improperly, but they're not a sympathetic figure to these individuals. That's not what they sign up for. They sign up to be a coach, to teach techniques, to be, you know, a little bit hard on them to get their highest performance out of the athlete. But when we talk about a little bit hard on them, there's a line. And where the line is crossed is what they don't understand. Because they just believe as long as they're winning, which we live in a win-now culture, as long as they're winning, that they're fine. And unfortunately, our society as a whole has generalized that as okay. Because if your team's 35-0 and you've won every game you possibly can, even the parents at fault with this too, but the organizations, the society in general, is at fault because we put winning in front of safety. And just because we can't see, you know, the brain damage, and the neuroscience sides cover this, we can see a broken arm, we know the kid can't play. I can give you instances where the coaches have looked at these kids and asked them if they could still play or forced them to still play. It's just as damaging, if not more damaging to the brain, because the brain takes much longer to heal and in some cases never heals, where a bone will heal. So what my research is actually showing currently is that, like I had stated prior, if the coaches perceive themselves to be one thing and they're actually another, if we don't show them, or if they're not educated in their ways, in their wrongs, then their ways will never change. So we just continue the pattern again.
Right. And what makes this a topic that we don't want to talk about again? We're happy to talk about kids bullying kids. And Jennifer, I think you talked about, again, some of the friend we had in common, John O'Sullivan, does a lot of good work with their Changing the Game group. You mentioned almost doublespeak and being, you know, Orwellian. What is it that are you finding, I guess, in that's, you know, amongst the witnesses, the rest of us, that in fact, you know, even now there are plenty of times like, you know what, I'm just going to keep walking. I mean, you know, in an office, you see something going on and you just don't want to get involved. What is that?
I think it's because the adults involved have a large amount of power. So they are able to, like if you're dealing with a bully on the playground, kids don't want to report it because they know it can often get worse for the targeted kid, or the bullying will switch to them. You know, we tell kids, oh, you should be an upstander, but that's a ridiculous thing to say to kids. Kids are smarter. They know the social structure. If you're an upstander, chances are good you're the next on the list to have the target come flying at you. Well, it's exactly the same thing with adults. Adults think, ooh, do I really want to speak up? That coach controls letters of reference, calls to university coaches, scholarships, recruitment, playing time. You know, if the coach is in charge of playing time and you're speaking up and complaining as a parent or calling them to account for their conduct, who's to say your kid's not going to sit on the bench as punishment? I mean, that's how the coaches, that these teachers, that's exactly how they did it. And kids got savvy to it, and they literally said in their reports, they said things like, he was being vicious. If it had been a kid, I would have stepped in, but I couldn't because it was a teacher. I didn't want to lose playing time. I mean, these are ambitious kids that want to play the next level. And, you know, the thing, so they have a huge amount of power, and parents know that. And if there's no checks and balances and there's no laws and there's no system that holds them to account, no one's going to take the risk. Plus, parents are befuddled. They've normalized abuse because the policymakers have normalized it. So while there's no, I can guarantee you, no parent is going to stand on the sidelines and watch a coach sexually or physically abuse their child, they will watch emotional abuse. And it's because they believe, and it goes back to Charles's thing about perception. You know, we've normalized abuse of children, essentially, is what's happened. Just like we normalized racism. We normalized smoking. We thought smoking was glamorous and it made you independent. But when science told us that was not true, when it told us that smoking was cancerous, then we started to find people who did it. We made laws. We said, you can't do it. You can't do it in the workplace. That's the kind of laws and penalizing and health initiatives we need around bullying. If you are emotionally abused by a boss in your office, a female boss, there should be a law in place that fines her $2,500 just like if she lit up a cigarette. It's cancerous, and especially with our children.
And I'll tell you on an exit interview that I've had, you know, Robin said, hey, you know, I think so-and-so could, you know, really use, this was years ago, some help, you know, good person underneath, but they just don't handle the, you know, the great days are good, but the bad days, they don't just handle, and they need some help. And the response I had gotten was not that we can't do anything. It was, yeah, we've heard that before. We just can't figure out how to do it. And I said, well, you're not doing so-and-so any favors. And, you know, that didn't end well years later for that person, where it's really hard. And I guess this is probably a good segue into Charles. Tell us about Athlete Guardian, because, again, this is, you know, Jennifer, you talked it as kind of being a scoop at this point, that this is something that's developing quickly, and it really can be something to tip the scales, get the momentum going in the right direction.
Well, Athlete Guardian was developed out of my research, which basically at the end of everything that I found so far is that the problem is obviously we have issues that we've talked about within victimization as a whole. But it seemed as if the majority of the problem was finding out what was really going on within the actual reporting system. We can support data all over the place that shows that anywhere between 10 and 15% of actual victimization cases are reported. And a lot of that is due to the fact that we deal in a society where if we report something face-to-face, we have instant ramification. We're being called liars, troublemakers, you know, being told that what we saw or what had happened to us was not true or was okay. And with that instant ramification or repercussions is basically the reason why we don't report. It's almost a form of shaming is really what it is. So what Athlete Guardian has created is developing a app that athletes or anybody within an athletic organization, because I'd like to specify the fact that victimization is not specific to youth, it is of all ages, that will be allowed to report via electronic device, cell phone, iPhone, tablet, Wi-Fi connection, if they are having a situation of they're being victimized in an athletic environment. Now, what makes this unique is that it actually protects multiple levels. So what happens is if your athlete is being victimized on the field, sometimes that athlete may not want to report or may not report. But beforehand, there would only be a set of two eyes on that situation. Now by putting this app in everybody's hands that's there, now you have hundreds of sets of eyes on that same situation. So the law averages says that somebody's going to say something. Without having the instant repercussions of reporting, because cell phones don't talk back, tablets don't talk back, Wi-Fi doesn't talk back to you, plus it's completely anonymous to the organization itself for the investigational process, people will be more apt to report. Now, the key to this is it goes both ways. Organizations now, there is a path of events when the report goes through that Athlete Guardian system will actually show that there is a report now. That report will go to the organization, and who the organization designates as their investigators will have the information provided, which includes the type of victimization, where it happened. It can upload video and photos of the incidents if you have them. You can write in exactly what happened. It shows that that the organization was informed. Then, in a manner of a third-party situation, Athlete Guardian also follows the investigational process. So it will show that something was done, properly or not, that the investigation was conducted on the side of the organization. So basically said, when we talk about Jennifer's situation a little bit, what this prevents is it prevents a organization coming up and saying, well, we never received any other reports, or we never received your report. And it also, it doesn't allow them to just sweep it under the rug. So because of this, we're protecting the organization from potential lawsuits, which is something that they need, because they really honestly have a hard time protecting themselves, which is the do-right situation. But when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars a year in lawsuits going, because a lot of the situations are the organizations just don't deal with the problem properly, we're also giving the individuals within the organization, the athletes, the coaches, the refs, the parents, the power to report these situations and know that they're going to be investigated. It, Athlete Guardians not only leveled the field from the imbalance of power that we see between coach athlete, athlete athlete, parent athlete, parent coach, coach ref, but it's also prevented the conflict of interest inside the organization, which, as we all know, even in business, school, athletics, in military for that matter, there's always an imbalance of power, a conflict of interest, when the organization that's conducting the investigation is the one that can be harmed by the findings. So when you have a situation with an app like this that's being used, where the investigational process is actually followed through the app, there's no way that they can brush it under. So something will be done about it. And then by also allowing the athletes or the individuals that report, if they choose to have that data or that report being filed by a third party, now you have the situation where if for some reason individual, say, is a youth and parents want to take the organization to court for wrongdoing or something to that effect, organization looks at them and says, well, we have no records. They get a subpoena or a warrant. Now they have the information that there was a report filed and it was received. So it also protects the athletes in that manner as well.
Two questions. I'm going to ask them both at once and let you respond in whatever order you like. But one, does the organization, let's call it a school or a rec council, do they have to sign up for it? And then two, we talk about the follow-up on action by Athlete Guardian. What is that? Is that a person walking over there? Is it a phone call? If you could expand on those two things, I think that's something the typical listener would kind of want to get their head wrapped around.
Okay, well, I'll answer the second one first, actually. The app is able to be used by anybody. The problem with it is, that's the wrong wording. It's really not a problem. The problem without the organization being involved is that their level of knowledge of the report becomes limited, and that's in any situation. So that's not just the fault of the app. But the watch part actually becomes it's internal within the app. So when the organization receives the information, there's a checklist that they have to go down within the investigational process.
Okay.
And then basically they check off as they do the investigation, and it's you can see it on the back side of the app that within the organization they've done this, they've talked about that, it's been declared that it's a blank situation and this and that. Now, individuals that do not have an organization that have signed up for use still do have the opportunity to use Athlete Guardian, but at that point, it's an instantaneous phone call, it's an email sent to the organization. The organization can do whatever they want with that information at that point, but there's still a data track that shows that there was a report filed. So it still does protect the athlete in both manners. If the organization is not signed up for use, it does not protect the organization in the same manner it does as if the organization has signed up. So in both situations that you stated, the athlete or the reporter is protected, but the organization is only protected with sign-up because Athlete Guardian does not have legal rights, nor does anybody else technically, to go in and conduct these investigations for these organizations. So being able to follow it is what they have to sign off on.
Okay. Jennifer, you were very excited when you were explaining this to me. How does this, let's go to the courtroom. What you've been looking at the law, and you mentioned that Canadian law and U.S. law follow each other pretty closely. How do you think this would play out?
Well, it goes back to what Charles was saying about essentially Athlete Guardian functions like a watchdog. So it creates health, in a sense, for an organization. The way I think about it is as an early warning system. So going back to what you said about coaches or somebody in the workplace, if you have someone who you're enabling and you're looking the other way and you're just letting the problem fester, like a Mike Rice, let's say, or let's look at U.S. Gymnastics or Penn State, I mean, these places, and it's the same thing with the school that I resigned from, they all harbor these individuals and they all try to cover up. And it goes back to Charles's point about conflict of interest. People get, they want to protect the adult. They think that they can solve the problem themselves by doing it behind the scenes. And, you know, inevitably what happens is the person just repeats the behavior. They're not going to get better that way. So you've got someone like Sandusky in his jail cell talking about how much he loves his victims, like going back to perception. You know, for him, it's all love. But on the flip side, on the legal side, it's abuse. And so you never go with the perception of the person. It's irrelevant, whether it's emotional abuse or sexual or whatever. But, I mean, in our situation, I mean, it was discussed widely, and we knew a number of very celebrated incidents even of the, certainly one of the coaches, you know, having a long history of this type of conduct and parent issues and child issues and teacher issues even with it. But when we went to the headmaster, he said there's no reports, 20-year history, no reports. So if Athlete Guardian had been in place, just as Charles said, we could have gone to them and said, okay, our lawyer is asking for this information. Do you have reports? Yes, we do. We have multiple reports every year, and it's the same thing happening over and over again. That's a game changer because an organization is going to know that. So an organization is going to say, okay, we need very clear rules around conduct. You break these conduct rules, we're going to send you to get better. You got to get rehab. You need to fix your emotional problem. We've all been raised in a bullying culture. We got to get better. And that, you know, that's where the neuroscience is really exciting because neuroscience knows now that our brains aren't fixed. We don't have to abuse forever. We can change and we can create whole new neural pathways that are constructed on compassion and empathy. And, you know, I want to, it's really important to me that we go back to that point about winning. I think one of the mistakes we make is that we think that we look the other way at this coach conduct because they win all the time, and they don't. Like, if you look at Mike Rice, he didn't have an incredible team, or many, many of the coaches. Certainly the coach that was reported on at our school, there was four coaches involved. They had terrible winning records. This one of them hadn't won in over 20 years. And we're talking a little provincial Canadian, you know, we're not talking America's intense pursuing of athletics. So, and also there's no research. There's no research that backs that coaches who use bullying tactics are construct winning teams.
Right. In fact, it's the opposite. And that's what a lot of what the Positive Coaching Alliance has gathered has been the latest research showing that it takes your mind off of what you're doing. I mean, because it really is something that completely focused, you know, demands the attention of the brain. And some of the, again, the book I was reading was talking about how it literally, the brain operates on different frequencies. It completely changes how it operates and has to be retrained, as a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, which is something I would have never thought. You know, it was just more of, well, I guess it's a fragile person. They'll have to get over it. Hopefully they'll forget. It is, like you say, it is a chemical, physical, electrical change in how it operates. And it can, and structural, right. The different parts connect differently, and it can be restored. But it's the kind of thing that, one, it's not the kind of thing you go to your general practitioner to fix, and two, knowing where to start. And that's actually the next thing is I had an incident about 10 years ago coaching, probably it was U11, and there was a girls team, and nice girl that she wouldn't talk to us. There were two of us guy coaches. And we were definitely the least intense. We were actually the two guys that were the officers for the Positive Coaching Alliance in our rec. And we just said, yeah, we're here to, you know, teach them to play, have a good time. But she wouldn't talk. She was mute, selectively mute around us. And it was, we just said, okay, let's find a way to get her involved. Let's pay her some attention. We just thought that was something that, you know, would kind of be a really great thing that he and I could look back on. And my wife works in school. She's a speech language pathologist, and she works with special ed and other situations. And when we were trying to describe it, she said to me, "You two are not qualified. You need to watch out what you're doing." And it was a warning that, you know, this is not something to take lightly. It's not going to be, letting them play a position. This was something deeper that was going on. So, and I've always remembered that. But so my question now is, for the average coach, as opposed to, you know, when you see, you know, they're not the abusive coach, but there's something that's going on elsewhere. Because, again, this isn't just about sports. Maybe they have a hard time in school. What is it we can do to at least not make it worse? You know, whether it's just connecting with the kid, not pushing them too hard. Do you have any opinions on that? That if there's something going on in the classroom and a coach can sense it and the average rec field, can they do anything to just maybe give that kid a chance to rebound and recover a little bit?
Do you want to jump in there, Charles? I of course have an opinion, but do you have something you want to jump in with?
Well, I feel like the best answer to that would be that if we give the coach the opportunity to actually say something and not put the coach in the position, as you stated in your situation, where you're not qualified, then allow them to have the opportunity to give it to somebody or to get it to somebody that is qualified. So Lord knows what was actually going on with this child. You personally, like you said, you really didn't have an idea of what was going on. They weren't talking to you. It could have been anything.
Right.
So the fact of the matter is that that coach, you in this situation, have had an opportunity to say something to someone or be able to, quote, report what was going on. An investigation would have shown that there was something wrong, at least hopefully would have found out there was something wrong going on, and it could have been addressed. So it's a complete circle in a manner of how you're protecting the athlete. And in this case, it would have been the coach protecting the athlete instead of victimizing the athlete. So I want to emphasize the fact that not all coaches are bad. And that's a key point. But not all individuals are bad in general. So when we discuss that, and I'll kick it back to Athlete Guardian just because it's a prime example. If that coach had an app like this or had the knowledge of who to even report to, which in a lot of situations with athletic organizations is a major problem in itself, that information would have at least been recorded and sent to the organization to say, hey, there's something wrong here. This should be looked at. This individual is not speaking, looks like they have a problem, has stated something, and that becomes record so that someone that is qualified to do something about it has the opportunity.
Yeah, and I think back to we had the woman that had was running the rec. She had filled in for us one day because each of us, my partner and I, we each were traveling. And we were talking afterwards, and I just said, hey, our goal has been to get so-and-so, you know, we were thinking of the social thing. That's how clueless we were. And said, you know, more of that. And she said, well, actually, she was talking to me quite a bit. And again, it didn't, at the time, didn't think much, but after talking with you and reading some other things, I keep thinking, wow, there was something there that we just represented something that was, you know, related to some other incident. And yeah, I wish now, I don't know where that girl is or how her life is, but I really wish there would have been something to, you know, again, to go to the rec and say, hey, maybe you can run this up a flagpole with, you know, something in the county or something like that. But there's something that seems unusual to us. This is not shy. And now, like I said, I know enough to recognize it having seen it. And boy, I would have liked to be able to just send that in and say, okay, I put it in the better hands, not me meddling and, and possibly making things worse.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it goes back to the statistics. I mean, Charles, you were citing statistics at the beginning around, you know, if a kid is being outright full-on, you know, bullied even by an adult or emotionally abused by an adult, that you're likely to get about 10 to 14% of them reporting. So we, you know, our kids, I think one of the most important things for coaches, you were asking, you know, what can a coach do? I think one of the most important things for student athletes and coaches and parents is to make a contract at the beginning of the year where there's some open discussion around this, where the team works together to draw up a line for everybody, including the coach, including the parents. You know, what is respectful? What is compassionate? What is abusive? You know, what words should never be spoken? Are personal attacks ever appropriate? Or is it really a technique and skill that we should be focused on? You know, I think if you invited kids in to speak on that level and you really taught them, this is emotional abuse and you need to speak up when it happens, or you need to much more safely use a reporting app like Athlete Guardian. You need to report it. Why? Because it's hurting, you know, one of your friends' brains, or it's hurting your brain by witnessing it. It's not good for the coach, and it's not good for anyone. It's, you know, you need to speak up. It's like we went through that phase where we taught kids to speak up about unwanted touching. And, you know, there's been a spotlight shone to a certain degree on sex abuse, but it's still obviously a massive problem. So we're not getting kids, we're not getting the message to kids about what is proper conduct. They assume it's proper because an adult is doing it, and they normalize it.
Well, I assume, again, like you say, you only need to be about 9 or 10 years old to say, well, you know, you just got to fight through it. That's just the way it is. You got to toughen up. And that is the problem with, they're hard to work with, but it's worth it. You know, when you see the results, you know, the results being, you know, whatever, it's a business result, the college you get into instead of high school. And and there's also that nostalgic, if you will. You know, everybody walked uphill to school through snow both ways. You know, well, Charles, maybe you didn't, being in Florida, but but, you know, you hear that, and, you know, I'm 48, and, yeah, I start thinking about certain things, like, well, wait a second, not sure I like this. You know, you laugh about it, and then you start wondering, you know, there's nothing traumatic, but I think that's a part where it's, well, that's just part of what you have to get through. And we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left here, and what I wanted to do is let the two of you make sure everybody understands how they can get a hold of you, because you do other things. I mean, you've got C2C Careers that you and Jennifer and Chuck, you know, you've got, you know, Athlete Guardian LLC. I'm sure there's some other things going on. Let's start with Chuck. Where can people, who, again, with your research, because as you mentioned, you've been through your exams, you'll be getting in your dissertation and defending all that. You've got, you know, a lot of good work coming up here. Where can they get a hold of you, whether it's by email, or what's the best way?
Well, the best way to contact me would be through charles@athleteguardian.com. You can contact me through social media at any time. Athlete Guardian has its own Twitter account, Instagram account, Facebook account. You can contact me directly. My Twitter handle is @RagingBull300. It's time for change, and I'd love to talk to anybody who would have questions, comments, ideas, just general interest. If they're having problems and need to be directed in a manner for help, anybody that would like an ear to lean on, I'm available. Please feel free to contact me.
Yeah, and Charles, tell them again, where in Central Florida are you located to? Because I think some people may not realize, in fact, that I've got two stories recently, someone that called me yesterday, that they're located in Florida. And again, even just, you know, being a little bit of face-to-face for, you know, a cup of coffee can do a lot. Where exactly might they find you?
I am just outside of Orlando in a town called Longwood, Florida.
And
but I was raised in Massachusetts, so I do know what snow is. Just saying.
Okay, I forgot about that. After 3 years down there, I did forget quite a bit. And Jennifer, now you do things besides the book. And actually, I do want to talk that real briefly, which is the C2C.
Well, at C2C Careers is a startup company, and they brought me in as an educational consultant, and I've actually been using a lot of my my educational background, but as well as the neuroscience. So one of the things that I'm working on is trying to help university grads or college grads transition from school or from college into the workplace much more smoothly. So 40% of them go into underemployment. Underemployment means that they work, you know, traditionally we say, you know, at a gas station or a barista or in, you know, administrative work or any of these types of jobs that don't require 4 years of college training. And so what I'm trying to do is really get corporations to understand that they're losing out because this is the era of brain plasticity. They're not getting these creative, innovative, risk-taking, unbelievable, fast-learning brains at the table working with them. They're letting them slip into jobs that don't require their skills. So I've been working really intensely on that actually for a year, but I always am working and writing and posting on sports and teaching bullying and adult bullying and the laws and how it needs to change because it's definitely my passion project.
And I think in particular the part on the law is the one that I think people will have quite a bit of interest in. Because as one caller talked to me yesterday, there is an issue with, again, a coach, you know, kind of harassing by text for, you know, years now, where, you know, when one kid want to go to a different club and then ignoring, the latest one was, you know, literally for the entire season, never spoke to a player to kind of get, you know, whatever, even with them for something. Yeah. And
it happens more than I like to admit.
Typical. That's typical bullying behavior is isolating the child, shunning the child. These are all the things that kids reported when I took their testimonies at this school. It's textbook.
Right. And they didn't say a bad word, not a harsh word to them. And that's where the thing that came out of it was there was someone trying to help who was in the legal community and had said, boy, I was trying to find just one piece of paper that says to take it to the school and say, look, here's the code of conduct. So-and-so isn't living up to it. And there wasn't one. And this,
well,
what do you mean there isn't one?
You know, Dave, the most important thing that's happened, and it's happened quite recently, is that in the United Kingdom, in England, they have passed a criminal law saying, or they have passed the law saying that emotional abuse is now criminal. The second emotional abuse in North America and elsewhere in the world enters into the criminal code, we're going to see radical social change. It's going to be amazing, but we have to do that. And it's not about shaming people or blaming them or punishing them or anything. All it's about is making people get educated and starting to work their hardest all together as a community for the best possible conduct. Why? Because there's serious repercussions if you don't. It's just like speeding in your car. If you speed in your car, if you steal a loaf of bread, if you do these types of things, the law comes down hard on you, and so you don't do them, right? You pay money or you have to even go to jail. So you don't do them. That's what we need is a deterrent law in place. But, yeah, there's a very interesting case as well that's gone forward to the federal court because the lawyer, it's in Ohio, and he just said football coach is God in Ohio. There's no laws that I can access that will protect these kids who've been brutally, brutally emotionally abused by this guy. And these boys, they're fed up. And they've launched a lawsuit against him, and the lawyer took it federal, which is really powerful.
Cool. And again, like I say, when I, you know, until I talked to you, this was not a topic I was expecting to get into, but it's one that I really couldn't deny, and I found it to be actually really central to the show's message, which is we're not talking to kids right now on the show. We're talking to the adults who work with the kids or the young adults, and that's why I'm so grateful you got in the show. Jennifer and Chuck, I definitely would like to have you on again because we've mentioned that we were going to burn through an hour in no time at all. So again, thank you very, very much. And let's have you on the show again.
Thanks
so
much, Dave.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
All right.
It was a great conversation.
Take care. And everybody, thank you for listening and tune in next show. Thanks a lot.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.